Michael Lopp, also known on the internets as Rans, is a writer, public speaker, and VP of engineering at Slack. And to learn more about Michael, please take a listen to our last episode together, which was in August of last year.
That was August?
Yeah. I went,
oh my gosh.
Really, August?
I'm still recovering from the new year.
Yeah.
Everyone kicked it in. And we got back from the new year all fired up and good to go. And
then it's March.
And then it's March. and it's still, everyone's still fired up and good to go. It's been a complicated year.
Do you guys take a quiet period at Slack
for
the holidays?
Yeah, a couple weeks in there.
We do that too.
Yeah.
Just structurally too, especially a service like Netflix, you really want to make sure it stays up during those holidays.
Yeah.
So we're pretty careful about it.
In a prior life, I was running the Apple store.
Yeah.
So the holidays were kind of important. So,
yeah
it was like super mega important.
Since you mentioned Apple Store, I almost never buy like movies because, of course, I work at Netflix. But I recently wanted to see something that was filmed in Boulder Creek, which is the town I'm in. I want to show my kids and stuff. It was built in the 90s. And I went around trying to figure out where I wanted to buy a video because I kind of wanted to own it so I could share it with other people. So I went to Amazon. I went to Apple. And I was like, where is it going to be easiest for me to have this for long term?
Right.
And I realized, you know what? It doesn't matter. One of them is going to be bad and I won't know for 10 years.
Is there going to be some way you're going to have to buy that movie again in the next 5 years?
Oh, yeah.
It seems how
I should have
worked.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, the next night my aunt asked about it and I was like, oh, no, here's the scene. And she's like, oh, great. So it was worth buying it, I guess. Your most recent blog post at Rans and Repose, people can read up on that and also learn more about you and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about performance management. And when you first started talking about it in the tone and such, I realized, oh, this must be a term that managers know. I don't know that term.
Interesting. I don't know if it's an industry standard term. But
you've run into it.
Oh, yeah. It's normally that state when you – and this is what I was cautioning in the piece was it's that state of mind where you're like, oh – I have an employee and I have to do something about it now, right? Which is absurd because you're worried about your employee. It's not worried. You're working on your employees the entire time. And it was cautioning against that mindset of going from, hey, what is working together and I'm coaching and listening and doing that thing into that, here we are and it's official because it makes it artificial. It could be a very serious situation, but it takes something that should be just a conversation and turns it into this, we're having an official conversation.
It's almost as if you're saying we're having an official conversation about your performance.
Right.
You're already saying we're going to let go of you now. Like it doesn't feel like there's much more dialogue that can happen.
It feels like that's what people hear between the lines, even when you've been warned, like have an official conversation. It's no longer a productive conversation. It's this fear-based conversation of like, what is my boss going to do now, right? As opposed to what you should have done every day before that, which is, hey, there's these challenges or these things you need to work on, and let's work on those, even if they're hard things or things which are going to require a substantive change to your behavior. So, but not going into that mindset of like, now let's do something about it, because now let's do something about it in my head moves from coaching into a threat, right?
It feels that way. Yeah,
it feels like a threat, even though you're not threatening or anything. It still feels like this is now an official thing.
Yeah. And so performance management was talked about. You defined it as a well-defined workflow that either leads to an employee's improved performance or the departure.
Right.
However, if you're a manager, that should always be your goal. That has nothing to do with any stage. You should be helping this person be better employee or letting them go.
Right.
Kind of all the time.
That's what you're doing the entire time. And that making it this official thing suddenly makes it something which you're not really even able to have a good conversation because all they're worried about is like, what is the consequence of if I don't do this thing? So it was putting work, lots of work in before you make that. Because sometimes you do have to do that. There's some reason to make it official and all of that.
And, you know, if you don't – I mean, if you understand as you're going through business school and you're being a manager, however you get learn that skill, you understand at some point there's going to be this time where even though you've hired this person or they've come onto your team or whatever, you've taken over somebody to the team, you're going to have to let them go.
Yep.
That's part of the job and you know that's part of the job. And if you haven't done that often, which means you have no idea how to do it, you're going to screw up the first time probably.
Right.
And it also is one of those things where it feels like, oh, I have the responsibility to do this thing I'm supposed to do, which you've never done.
Right.
This is a very challenging part to be in as a manager.
But I think that's what leads to the performance management inflection point, which is usually the reason you get there is – well, one of the ways that you can get there is like delivering a hard piece of feedback and like, I have to say this thing that she's not going to like or he's not going to like. So you avoid it and then it actually just gets worse and you don't get a practice actually giving that feedback, which is – So it often is negligence that leads to this thing where you're suddenly like, well, I need help and let's call HR or do this sort of thing. And this is why a lot of employees, the first time they have the conversation, the performance management conversation, they're like, this is literally the first time I've heard this. And sometimes there's some denial there and you've been trying to say it, but very often you just really haven't said it, or you haven't said it with the punctuation that you're using in that conversation.
Well, that's the really tricky part of this, right? Because you have to both be a human and also give extremely difficult feedback, yep. and you're in an obvious power situation because you're a boss.
Yeah.
So you have frame this whole story of kind of interrupting somebody saying, before they say performance management, don't get them in there, and you say to them, in your quote is, have you had multiple face-to-face conversations over multiple months with the employee where you have clearly explained and agreed there is a gap in performance? And then your whole article really breaks down that sentence.
Right, right.
But one of the things I think is really interesting is multiple over months.
Yeah.
Really? Like if you see someone who's not performing well at any job they're doing,
yes.
I'm assuming you mostly manage managers, but let's say you're even managing an IC and they're like a programming something and they said that they're going to hit a milestone and it's months later and they haven't.
Right.
At that point, when you realize there's really kind of a problem, you're still going to spend months with this person?
Yeah, I am, because let's use your hypothetical example, which is they missed a deadline. It's not that the deadline is a thing you can measure, but there's there's many ways for you to figure out that it's trending in the wrong way. They're bad at estimates. They're not working that hard. Whatever that sort of set of things is that you have to pay attention to before you even get to that milestone. You know they're going to miss the milestone.
You should have been talking every week with them. You know.
Right. Right. Like, you have that context. And the reason I put it over multiple months is I'm assuming it's a scenario where it's not like obvious, like they are stealing or something where it's obvious you're going to let them go. But it's something where it's probably hard for you to like have the conversation because it's something that's tricky or it's complicated or involves emotions or whatever, all these humans and their curious behaviors. But it's something where, and by the way, let's just assume you screw it up the first time that you say, hey, by the way, your estimate was X and it was X plus Y, right? Let's talk about that piece. But not doing it in that mindset of like, this is a big deal. Just let's have that conversation. I wanted this. This is what I observed. What did you see? Make it be awkward, but if you script the first time, let's do it again. The point is to have the conversation a couple times because you're practicing too on giving that feedback. That's probably harder than normal to give because you're thinking about it a lot more, and months. Because if we're talking about a change in behavior, maybe you don't have the right coaching. Maybe you don't have the right assessment. You know, there needs to be some debugging on it. There needs to be a couple of different attempts. Like, hey, by the way, maybe we should just pad your estimates. That's a really bad idea. But like, but let's talk about like what the root cause is and talk about the behavior and work on it for a bit. So again, it's assuming there's not a horrible situation here. If it's something that you have to deal with in a timely fashion, great. But here, let's work on it a bit.
So you're really saying that multiple months is not, now I know there's a serious problem with this employee.
Yeah.
Now let's work multiple months. You back up and go, no, you start working earlier. You should have known this a long period of time. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because I think it's for new managers. We just avoid some of the hard things because of the people things, because they're not as obvious to us how to proceed about building a piece of software or, you know, building a process or whatever that is. So again, give yourself lots of months to work on those hard topics.
Okay, so I gave a little bit of an outline for our conversation. I realized that this is a perfect time to actually talk about the way we do feedback here at Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
We do this process of always very honest feedback all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've definitely done a thing where we have a meeting and then a little bit later, I've never talked to this person before, we do a meeting, a little bit later I call them for a one-on-one, we chat.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes both back and forth. And that honest feedback is also structured annually in this process we call 360, which is basically give feedback to anyone you think you could help.
Right.
And the whole point of this kind of feedback label is to say, there might be something I'm noticing that I can share with you so that you can be better at what you do.
Right.
And that's the whole goal of it. When I first thought this process through and did this, I thought this is crazy.
Right.
But I've been here for 4.5 years or so, and I have seen other people and myself change from feedback given.
Yep.
I find that shocking. I wouldn't have believed that without experiencing it. But you've been managing people for a long time. You've got books on the topic and everything. How is it that people are able to take in feedback that's kind of fundamental to how they act and change?
Well, let's first talk about why performance management is bad. The inflection point is if I'm when you're getting critical feedback from somebody, right?
Oh, yeah.
I wrote
the
about
tone
this in the piece.
Changes.
The tone changes. they've scheduled the meeting at a weird time. I'm quoting the article right now, but like you're like I am preparing for something.
Yep.
And you're not preparing to listen. You're preparing to like brace yourself.
Yeah.
And the mindset is so different than just you and I chatting and I saying, hey, I like your shirt and that's kind of cool and this sort of. That's the goal with all feedback is to make it something where you're not sitting there getting into this mindset of fear or I'm about to be attacked or whatever your brain is doing about whatever it's doing when it's hearing that critical piece of feedback. But getting to that state, getting that state with your manager or your peers or whatnot involves building trust and respect, which is why, and I'm writing about this in another article on feedback right now. This is why I'm always asking for it because you want to diffuse that energy around mm-hmm. critical feedback and just know that like we had this great training at a prior company. The line was feedback is a gift.
That's we say that, yes.
It's a gift,
it really
right?
is.
And it's something that this person that is not threatening you, that is just sitting there observing this thing. And by the way, they could be totally wrong, but even the chance just to share it and that they care enough to do that is signal in itself, mm-hmm. right? And that's the religion around feedback that you want to kind of build.
Because we all know that's hard to do.
Yeah.
So if someone's doing it, it means something right away that they went past that barrier.
Right.
Unless they're a complete jerk, which you're going to learn quickly anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
But most of the time, it's like someone spending some time to be thoughtful and having the bravery to engage with you in the conversation.
And it's also encouraging ideological diversity because especially me, I'm a manager, I'm a VP, blah, 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 whatever. I'm wrong a lot of the time and I want people to raise their hand and give me the feedback and tell me what's going on because that happens less in my role because there's this hat that says VP on it, right? And people are like, well, he must know. And it's like, I've done a lot of things. I've written some books, but I screw up daily. And the way I will screw up less is those people around me who have different perspective, different context, different data about the situation go like, hey, Lob, did you think of this? Or I saw this or that sort of thing. This is the amazing thing is like being surrounded by people where there's that healthy feedback system. It's error correction. It's better product. Yeah. It's safer environments. Yeah. All of these things come out of that.
What was the last time you screwed up with?
Today?
Sure.
What did I screw up today? I over-prepared for a meeting. I had 10 minutes and I had about 3 hours of slides. And I had all these people put together this huge amount of – and I'll use it elsewhere. But it was maybe, let's call it 80 hours of time mm-hmm. for a 10-minute presentation. And the reason I screwed up was I did a disservice to how much there was so much that I wanted to report on that I fire hosed the people who were receiving it.
Right.
And it was amazing work. This is like work since the beginning of the year. And it did a disservice. I think
it's kind of like a synopsis of your team's work.
Yeah. But it's a whole bunch of teams. Mm-hmm. Like, we're working on this thing. And I felt like I could have delivered a more compelling narrative in a 10-minute period. So it's not a screw-up, but it's just I felt like I didn't represent my team as best as I could. So
it's so funny. It sounds like a really bad answer to the question in an interview of like, how have you screwed up? I over-prepared too much.
No.
But it is true. It's a waste of resources, right?
Yeah. No, yeah. It was – no. I mean, we'll use it for other things. Sure. But it's that as well as I wanted to tell a better story than I did. And mm-hmm. I was wanting to get through so many things. I was talking really positive, blah, 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 blah. And like, by the way, that even doesn't give people the opportunity to go back to our other topic, which is give me feedback on this. Did that resonate? Because everyone was like, he is talking fast. And this team is cranking on stuff. But I'm getting like half of it because he's just moving so quickly.
Yeah. I find it's also interesting when you're kind of forcing this feedback. When we do the structured forcing feedback, what's very easy to do is I have something hard to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So first I'll tell you some great stuff. And then I'll tell you the hard thing. And then I'll tell you some great stuff again. So we kind of coach people against doing that. But I still, in the feedback I see, anytime I've got something that's going to be hard, it's prefaced with great work, Lyle, which isn't bad to do. I mean,
no,
there's nothing wrong.
As long as those compliments are not like vapid, like nonsense, where you're like, well, you're looking great today.
Right.
And you screwed that entire thing up. But you look sharp. One way we solved this in a prior company was we just had a language around feedback. And we had coaching about how to do it. But mm-hmm. you knew when the following phrase showed up that you were getting ready for feedback. And it was zero poetry. I have some feedback for you. And those words were your trigger in a good way of like, okay.
Time to listen,
right? Don't judge. And this is another thing I've been writing about recently is when the hard feedback still comes, when I am getting that, when I'm that hair in the back of my neck is standing up, I'm getting it. It is, like you just said, it's just you can't react. By the way, if it's super hard, your worldview is going to be altered, and there's no way that you can do the math on all the implications of what that person is saying.
By definition, you don't know what's going on.
Exactly.
Like, it's new.
It's new. So, and I usually, on like big, huge feedback, I need like a couple days to kind of be like, huh, how do I really feel about that? So, but it is important to A, listen, and maybe just a smidge of understanding about what they're saying, but really not to actually react. So what I always do is I say, okay, that was big. And I repeat back what I heard just to make sure that my new data is actually error corrected.
Because
sometimes I go, do you mean this, this, and this? Like, no, you heard it completely wrong. I'm like, okay, good. Can you say it again? Yeah. And then we can get that piece in place.
You had another piece, and I don't really recall what it was of yours, about being kind of the last person to speak in a group. And one of the hard feedback I got from a manager this time around for this 360 was first something complimentary, which I think is honest and genuine, which is great. But then the second piece was really you have an opportunity to listen more without speaking. You know, I obviously have been doing podcasting for a long time. I'm from a theatrical family. I have no problem talking any kind of meeting. Anybody in the room, I'll give my opinion, and they're normally well-formed when all that.
Right.
But if I do that quickly, other people will just shut up.
Yeah.
And that was the feedback I got kind of from my direct manager. Just give opportunity to other people to speak. But I love the other thing that you said. So give me your thought about waiting.
Well, I'm a poker player. And acting last in poker you have the most amount of information, which means you can make the best decision. Poker, everyone bets and you kind of go around in a circle and – I love it. Acting last is the most powerful position to be in because you can see what everyone else is indicating with their bets or their folding or whatever they're doing. I like to do that at meetings as well. I'm the VP of engineering, so I don't want to create that. I don't want to bias the room by saying, by the way, it's X. Or, I believe it's X. Or like, this is just my thought, but it could be X because everything after that is structured around that. So,
because as the VP of engineering, you know technical things that nobody else knows, and kind of how the team can operate and possibilities of physics.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of weight to what you say.
Yeah, it is, and I'm cognizant of that, and that's why I like to. But I also like to work with the most amount of information possible. So hearing everything else, I can kind of go like, well, I kind of think it's this or this sort of thing. So. Yeah, it's poker and it's leadership.
Well, okay. To wait till you get all information and then make decisions, definitely leadership. Like that's a smart thing to do. You're relying on these people, especially if it's partly your team or people that are working with you.
Yeah.
But at some level too, a leader also says the thing they think they should say and lets other people bounce off. Like you're not giving other people in the room necessarily the opportunity to hear you first.
Right. That's true. Well, is your observation, am I going to change what I'm going to say at the end?
I hope you'll change what you say or you're not using that benefit, right? But other people could have the benefit of you speaking first, yeah?
But they're still going to – I mean, it depends on the topic, right? If it's like, hey, it's a hiring decision and I am the decision maker, then I'm making the decision. If it's a big, huge thing that is multiple different teams, what sort of thing, you know, it's me kind of weighing in last. And I don't always do that, by the way. There's sometimes where it's like – hey, this is going to be a 4-hour conversation, but I'm going to weigh in first because I'm pretty sure this is the thing to do. So I'm going to save everybody about 3 hours of debate here. But that's a situational call. But it's even in the case where if I'm making a decision, I'm just weighing in. Those are two different mindsets. And I'm just weighing in. I'm going to say, hey, this is how I think and da-da-da and leave room for like, hey, let's go have a larger discussion about
it's
this.
It's not like you finished the conversation with that. You're just participating too with more information.
Yeah.
Well, I like that idea. And of course, since this feedback I got from my supervisor about like shutting up and listening for a while and making sure that people have voices, I've noticed that I'm inviting people to speak that wouldn't normally speak just by not saying anything. But especially if I hear a topic point and I know that somebody else in the room kind of knows a bit about it, I can just look at them. And because I normally speak a lot, people look at me.
Yeah.
And then they look at me looking at them and then they look at them and then the person speaks. It feels good.
There's an advanced move there too, which is you can tell. I love watching a table of people and figuring out who wants to speak and whatnot. You can tell when someone's trying to say something, but they're not. It's going too fast and everyone's going fast and furious. So there's another one which is like, hey, Phil, you have something to say? Yeah. So and that just is an amazing thing to kind of balance out the power dynamics. And like, especially when there's a lot of high power people sitting at the table, kind of making sure that everyone gets represented.
You're also representing the idea of curiosity amongst the people, right? Yeah. So you're changing the tone of the conversation to be curious, which of course is more effective in getting consensus.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. The ideas don't get better with agreement. They get better with like all sorts of perspective being thrown on the table. So yeah. I want to hear as much as possible.
What I think is kind of a problem of our day is actually a post of yours from 2014. And the title of your essay is The Builders. It's funny. I want to call it an essay instead of a blog entry because I feel like it's more respectful. Your blog post, whatever. The Builders High. And you just talk about that kind of creativity and what kind of high you get from creating.
Yeah.
And mostly about writing, of course, because that's your form of creation.
Totally. Right.
And in that, you talk about people looking at their phones.
Yeah.
And it's just gotten worse, right? There's so many people consuming with small – I don't want to, you know, be judgmental, but vapid input into like or dislike or, yeah, I believe that too. It burns a lot of time and energy.
Yeah.
Do you think it's unique to our day and age, or do you think we've always had this quality about us?
I think we've always been built that way, that we're interested in, we're curious.
Yeah.
And I think that we've built a set of products and services and whatnot that are literally designed and learning how to give us more of that. And by the way, it's not just that it's a, you know, an algorithm sitting there figuring out what's popular. Everyone's there curating for us. Like one of my favorite things to do that's vapid and useless and my wife hates this is I have my iPad and I just go to the front page of Reddit. And by the way, front page of Reddit it's amazing. It's like stupid stuff and interesting images and whatnot. But like every day I could go read that for 45 minutes. And there's, as opposed to reading this lovely book that I have about, you know, how forests work, right? But I'm doing that because our brain does like to be stimulated. And these services and tools that I've been a part of and built are just designed to feed that short attention span and that it's just completely sugary sort of highs, right? And I'm part of it. I do it. But I think it's as important, and I think about a lot with my kids, is to get that same high that you get of like actually creating something, because it's actually 10 times better, right?
Create something?
To build a thing, right? That's the thing that's really, to me, when I get a thing done, when I ride my bike and get a long ride into this sort of thing, it's actually 10 times better than those little micro kind of highs that you get of like, ooh, that was an interesting tweet. Ooh, I liked that. Or I'm angry about this thing. I'm going to downvoted or whatever.
What do you think that extra? Why is it 10 times better?
Well, I'm biased, but I think bringing something new into the world is like a noble thing to do.
So you mentioned writing, but just a moment ago you also mentioned biking.
Yeah.
But biking is not bringing anything new into the world, but it still feels good, like that success aspect.
It's still that accomplishment, like okay, I'm going to go ride 30 miles up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and I'm going to eat right. I'm going to drink the water. I'm going to do that thing, and I'm going to get that thing done. It's not a building thing, but it's an accomplishment thing.
It's like, also your body, and so from just the endorphins and everything that your body produces, it feels good that way.
And
too.
By the way, it's a fine point. I do some of my best strategic work sitting on my bike because I'm not sitting on the front page of Reddit. I'm not like watching a movie or playing a video game.
Rain doesn't take that much brain power.
It doesn't. And everything that I'm working on, like I'm always working on three or four big, huge things in my head. I'm sitting there and I kind of I get the most interesting inspirations. Like, oh, I just need to DM that. Our general counsel is one thing. And it was, that's exactly right. And I would not have gotten that if I hadn't given myself that time to be outside of all these sort of addictive loops that we
do. Jot that down? Because that's the problem with me and doing something else and having inspiration is that I lose it sometimes.
Yeah, I have a list that I put in my head because if it gets above like four or five, and it's just how many items are on the list and what's the word to remember it. So I just a pointer into the thought. So that's how I remember.
So it's like a little tiny a micro memory palace of three items.
So I can do all that, and like as soon as I get back, it goes into whatever I'm using. For
that's
my
good.
System.
As long as they're short things, you're not.
Yeah.
And of course, if it's lots of things kind of flying all over the place, probably none of them are that valuable anyway. It's really that kind of long.
But those things are already – that's already happening when I get on the bike. Right. And then it's sorting through and going, oh, that's important. That's not important.
Right.
Another one that I really love that helps with my writing is when I'm riding my bike, I'm working on a piece. And I'm like – I can see the whole piece in my head.
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, I don't have an intro yet. And it's this and it's that. And then oh, that's two paragraphs right there. So, I mean, I'm like literally doing the editing on a piece. And again, that's not something I can do at my keyboard. Keyboard is kind of get it out and sort of sort it through. You know, I print it out, edit it somewhere else. But when I get on the bike and I work on it, I find it's not even blocks. It's just sort of different ways to kind of view things. So mm-hmm. it's still the same thing of sort of that sense of building as opposed to consuming.
Okay. So with regards to building and consuming, one of the things that you kind of highlight in that piece is that when you push that button to publish it to the internet, the world,
yeah.
it feels really good.
Yeah.
How much of that is creating a piece you're proud of and how much of it is waiting for feedback from people?
It's the feedback's important, but the feedback is, I do care about it. Like the blog, which I've been doing for a very long time now, is definitely, its shape has changed. There's weird things I put in there now and then, but its shape has changed based on how reactions to the pieces. I probably would not have written a couple books on management without the positive feedback from the audience. Mm-hmm. So, but the point is more, there's folks that are sitting there and they're writing in the journal and that's great. There's something, I don't know if the word is brave, there's something about the accomplishment of putting it out there.
Yeah.
And being judged, I don't know if that's the right word, but like having it out there and doing that, like you brought something in the world to share with us, right? And I think that's, whether it's good or bad, who cares? You chose to actually go and do that. And you're part of this community, you're part of this village, right? And like, I think there's something cool about doing that. So the feedback's important. It's not, and I do like, I hit publish and I kind of wait a couple hours. I'm kind of checking Twitter. I'm like, did it do well? Did it do poorly? But here's the thing, after years and years of doing this, I just wrote this piece called How to Rans, which is the user manual for me as a manager. Like, hey, this is how I work, right? And I was done with that piece, and I didn't care if one person read it. It was like
documenting what you do, right?
No, it was really easy to write, yeah. and I got a lot of good feedback from people that I trust a lot, but I didn't need it at all. I was like, this is meaningful to me. And I wouldn't have gotten that without doing a lot of writing and a lot of building of things.
Yeah. I find that when I create stuff, physical stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
At work, I'm doing a lot of virtual things, right?
Right.
A great term for it. I was trying to say that software wasn't real, but I got a good argument and lecture about that from a PhD student. But it's really that it's not material.
Right.
And materiality is important. You know, we're humans. We like to touch and feel things.
Yeah.
And software you see, of course, unless you're doing robotic work.
Right, right.
But in general, it's visual only and, you know, you can touch a piece of glass, but that's about it from the stuff I do.
Yeah.
So when I'm not doing that, I'm doing things with my hands. I'm doing woodworking or recently got into blacksmithing.
Ooh.
And I find that a big part of that for me is doing some kind of time lapse of my work or showing what I'm doing, twisting steel, and then sharing that and getting feedback from people I know and people I don't know. And I'm looking at that and going, well, I know it has value to me just doing it. And then maybe having an item like a bottle opener or something that I've made and I give to somebody, that feels good as a gift and all that.
Right.
But there's something else there that's next to it the entire time of this kind of like, Lyle's a cool person to look at from afar. And I know a lot of people look at you from afar and see what you do and impress. I'm just curious, do you try to push that motivation away from you or do you embrace it? Do you think about it?
Let me say something about the process of blacksmithing and those things about documenting that before I answer your other question.
Okay.
I think the other thing about sharing your things with other folks is you want the feedback, but there's another thing that's kind of an editor. There's someone out there who's kind of editing your stuff. There's another piece there that I love to hear what people, whether it's positive or negative, get that feedback. And it's an editing process. And I hated the editing process when I started writing because I didn't want to, because everything I wrote was perfect, right?
Right. You don't want judgment.
But feedback, right? That's right. The other piece is there's that feedback piece that I think is incredibly important. Do I embrace it? What was the question?
It's like the public persona of being online and being known and having people look at your work and everything. How much of that is kind of like deciding what you're going to say next, what you're going to do next, or how much you're going to share? When you do your beautiful pictures on Instagram of where you were or whatever, how much of it is like showing off? And I only say that because that's the negative connotation of it.
Yeah. I'm twisting your question a little bit here.
Please
but
do.
There's no – I'm not choosing to do things because I know they're going to be interesting online. I'm happy to have a life where there's things that I'm doing that I'm kind of like, oh, this is kind of cool, right? Oh, yeah. I'm in Toronto, and what is the name of that tower? There's a CN tower. It's like a big tower, right? I'm going to take a picture of that. So It's not, there is a sharing aspect there, but it's more, this is my life. And it's not, I would have a problem with it if I was like, well, I haven't posted in a while. And, or I need to do this thing, or like
if I only drive a half an hour to this point, I can get a good picture.
Right,
then you know you're doing something wrong.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And by the way, I want to live a life that's worth talking about, not from a bragging sort of perspective, but so I can have these interesting stories about that time I was in Toronto, or you know that bike ride I did, or that article that I wrote. So I think I have a healthy relationship with what I'm sharing.
Do you think about it? Or is this the first time you thought about it in a while? I mean, I'm just curious.
I'm aware of the things that I'm sharing, whether that's Instagram or writing a thing or doing a talk. So I'm aware of that, but it's more, here's the thing. There's probably a future where I can do consulting and management and this sort of thing. And a lot of friends have gone and done the same thing. I have zero interest in doing that because what I want to be doing is something that's like real, as opposed to talking about doing the work. I want to do the work every single day.
You want to build things.
I want to build things and have a story to be able to tell about. So it's all sort of a hobby relative to the art of building Slack or raising a family or living in the Santa Cruz Mountains or this sort of thing. So it all feels kind of like a byproduct, it's work. It's not work. It's something that I have to do, but it's not a deliberate thing. Like there will be a couple of weeks I won't post Instagram because nothing really Instagram worthy happened.
You wrote this fun article about your home screen of your iPhone and kind of a documenting. It's of course one of those things that people that are really knowledgeable geeks, when you share what you're using, it's very useful to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Even you and I could both share a couple apps to each other that would change us, right? Because I found something great, you found something great, and it's cool.
Yeah.
But it's also very beneficial for someone who's like using Facebook on their phone and they don't know anything else. They're using the built-in calendar app on iOS, which is not good.
Right.
And so we can help those people.
I feel responsible
to do that, especially with family and such. So your post is kind of just walking through the apps and stuff. I thought it was kind of fun. One of the things you mentioned is like share your home screens because your home screen is pretty and like plain. And a few of us did. And I posted mine, which was this color coordinated thing.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. I liked it. And it was kind of an odd thing. Basically, imagine all your icons in colored folders and a background image that is also colored.
Yes.
And then, you know, you retweeted or something like that and it became kind of a top of your feed and I saw what you go through.
Right.
I was like, because just got posted and posted my Twitter account, all of a sudden I turned off notifications. I hadn't done that before.
Right.
So just seeing that kind of storm of output, outside input from like most of the people that I follow and follow me and talk, I know I've met at a conference or something, 1,000 people or something like that. You're talking, I don't know how many people that are commenting, but a lot of people.
Yes.
And seeing that felt a little overwhelming to me.
It was a deliberate experiment.
Sure.
First off, I put out a tweet and said, hey, home screen. And someone else did it, you know, New Year sort of thing. That's kind of one of the things people would do. And I started getting some just amazing responses. And I don't normally retweet or like much. I don't actually do that because
– why not?
I feel like it's a broadcast medium and it's not about creating a social network inside of Twitter. But I got so many interesting ones that I literally was like, retweet. And then they started to come some more, and I was like, well, this is interesting. How far can I push this? So then I put another tweet. I was like, I'm loving these. Please keep sending them. And then I got flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And I did something I'd never, ever do, which was just a retweet storm of really anything that was compelling to me. And as you saw, there was
a lot
of amazing work. People figured out how to do blank app icons, so they have these interesting arrangements. People did just amazing things combining their wallpaper with their images. It just went on and on.
I loved looking at them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
it's interesting, too, because it's a very personal space that we all interact with. And if we spend time and energy in it and then you share it all of a sudden, it's a very different experience to share that.
Yeah. It was the Twitter traffic on that was ridiculous.
Okay. So I saw an unusual one because
that was the only time I've ever done that. And I look at tweet stats every now and then. I was like, this was 300,000 people that were looking at this.
People care about this.
It was really, but it was also, I learned something about Twitter there. I got some people, like I said, please stop, like 3 or 4. That's not a lot of people relative to the amount of people that were reading that stuff. So I think in general, the community, unless they are like silently raging about me somewhere else, was interested in that. It was legit, like, visual, like, stimulus.
Well, it makes sense, right? Because we're all spending so much time looking at these screens, but they're totally ours.
Yeah.
And 15 years ago, we didn't have them.
Right.
So it's a very different space. We don't have a dialogue around it, really.
But it's the same thing you said this at the beginning. Like, I like to go and see people's development environments. You don't have to say anything. I just want to look over your shoulder and watch you work for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's always fascinating. I mean, like, why did you choose that font? What's that color?
Oh, you're using Vim. Why are you using Vim?
Da, 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 da. And you're like, and you watch them do whatever magical thing they can do with their setup.
Someone that can really move without a mouse is always a joy to watch.
Or like a finance guy or gal with a spreadsheet. I'm like, can you like, I had a business meeting a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, can you model this? And literally, in my head, I'm like, this is probably like a weekend task. They're like, click column pivot. And they're like, you mean it's 27? And I'm like, What the hell? Like, slow your roll.
You're
there.
Probably like me on that. You can do the work, but you only do it every 3 months, and so you never get good at
it. And I'm constantly retraining myself. But that was what was really interesting, was learning. It's a personal space, but also just how much the home screen is not. I mean, the whatever the app launcher is, it's just not that complex. But what people have done with it is just gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of like that it's not complex. I kind of there's been a long time ways of doing really complex things in the Android ecosystem. Okay, so let me just talk about a couple of the things that I noticed on your home screen, because you also show your home screen.
Yeah.
One of the things you shared was 1Password. In fact, it's the dominant upper left corner app, and 1Password is a password database that's encrypted. You basically put all your passwords in that and use only 1Password to unlock it. Of course, you probably have the desktop extensions, and it's on your phone as well. I use it as well. I've had it for a long time.
And it's in Dropbox, so all the passwords are synced and everything's magic.
Yeah, it's really great. And when I talk to people that don't have that system, I go, how you're failing. Because the truth is, if you're online, you have 50 accounts, and if you have the same password, you've got a serious problem.
Yeah.
And so this kind of helps you get away from that.
I was a prior company, and I was describing to one of my direct reports, I'm like, hey, I've got this spreadsheet that has a password on it, and all these passwords are in there. He's like, you don't have 1Password? And I'm like, oh, no, actually, I describe it. It's like, what I want is I just want to hit a keyboard command, type in my password once, and then have it go. And he's like, you want 1Password? I'm like, you mean this exists? And he set it up, and I was like, oh, my God, because it was just – I want to be security conscious. And
on the desktop, it's so wonderful.
Oh,
it works so well.
Yeah, and on mobile, it's not great because – You don't have that little keyboard command to like just dump it in there. So it's still like this four-step process to get it. But it's better than, you know, just
anything
having
else. Really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, so I like it. And I'm also kind of always in the space of – I've been doing stuff, you know, websites for places for a long time. I definitely have duplicated passwords out there.
Yep.
You know, it's the site where like, oh, there's a new service. I don't even know if I like it. I make an account.
Right.
Months later, it becomes Twitter. You know, that kind of thing is happening lots of times. Most of the time, they don't become anything, but you have the account.
Right.
So there's a few passwords like that, and they're in my management software. But when you really look at like trying to go through and change them, it's the one time I've thought, I'd really love to be able to pass this off and pay someone else to do it.
Right.
Because it's too time consuming, hundreds and hundreds of sites.
Yep.
But of course, once you do that, you have a trust problem, right?
Right.
Who do you pay to do that? So it's a challenge. It's also really highlights how different every site does all their stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, 1Password's pretty good at it, but lots of times it would be you created the account on the registration space, and so now every time you try to log in with it, you go to the registration page in which it fails.
Right. Or you do it on a mobile app, and on the desktop it has this nice thing. It tries to detect when you're putting in a password and says, hey, by the way, you're saving a password. Do you want to save that? And like 99% of the time it works. Doesn't work on mobile, so you've got to get it in there.
So on mobile, you're like, oh, I'm going to make an account. So you go to 1Password, you make an account. It's definitely challenging. The thing that I'm always curious about is everyone has this problem, I'm assuming. So execs at Apple have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the Apple infrastructure is just not as – some things have been great. Like if you want to take a photo and share a photo between apps on Apple – it's completely seamless. It's very easy. In fact, there's other apps that you can take the photo with, but it all goes in one place. It's very – it's universal.
Yep.
They don't have this with passwords. Why?
Well, you're out of my area of expertise.
Sure.
But I expect that actually, they do have it right now. In Safari, you can actually start to save to a keychain, right? So that's – they've started to do that there. So that's there. But there's something about iOS that it's – they have decided not to – because it's in the sandbox and it's very secure. Whatever those equivalent hooks are on the desktop, it is not to their strategic advantage to do that, because otherwise it would exist, right? So I believe they've chosen security over a convenience there would be my completely uninformed technical opinion.
I agree with you. I think that's totally my opinion too, is that the complexity and potential security vulnerabilities of implementing something like that.
Right.
But what that results in is people having really bad passwords, of course, is the bane of our current era, right? Like that is the problem we have.
Well, remember that they have also put together something absolutely amazing, which is Face ID.
That's true.
Which is a different way into that, and you still have to map that into what is the path. But like, that's magic to
that
me.
That is magic too. So, I didn't think I'd like it as much as I do. I love the iPhone X Face ID.
If we can map that into some mechanism where it knows about trusted passwords and whatever, like, I am so cool with that. So.
What I want to see is that the 1Password app is not a prominent place on your screen.
Right.
Because it should be – it's totally fine for the app to exist. It should just integrate more usefully.
Right.
So it's one of those ones where I hope in 4 years when next time you do one of these, that's not there.
Yeah.
But you're still using the app. I think the app is great.
Yeah. And the other thing I like – you haven't mentioned this yet. They do a really good job of alerting you to like sites that have been compromised that you can go and look and see like – by how long since you've changed recent passwords. So like every Sunday morning, I spend like 10 minutes deleting old things, updating passwords that are old and kind of
doing small parts. Yeah.
Doing small and just maintenance of that. I think that just keeps you, a little safer.
And they do highlight that. That is really quite nice. Yeah, that's true. All right. Next one I want to talk about was actually weather. So you're using an app called Dark Sky.
Yes.
And which is a paid for app. And you're also using Wonderground.
Yes.
Why do you have two weather apps taking up your... First off, of course, you're not going to use the Apple weather app because it's no good.
It's no good.
Why are these two? Why are you using these two apps at once?
I love this question. First off, we talked beforehand. Why do I care about weather? Biking. So I want to know whether or not I'm going to be able to bike that day. I just care about kind of what the weather's like in this world of kind of uncertain times, knowing that it's going to rain. We're like, hooray. So what's the difference between the two? First off, weather apps and like productivity apps, I will always give them a whirl. Like, it's not a solved problem yet, so I want to go and see what everyone's doing. What I like about Dark Sky is Dark Sky does a really good job of a sort of a map of the weather around you, and they also do really good alerts in terms of like it's going to rain in 10 minutes. They don't tell you it's going to rain in 3 hours, but in 10 minutes they'll tell you, and they're almost always right.
Oh, that's kind of nice.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's better than going, oh, the barbecue outside.
Right.
Yeah, after it's wet. Yeah.
It's that. I think it's also just a beautifully designed application, Dark Sky. Wonderground, the thing that they do so well, it's super nerdy, is they have this 10-day forecast graph, which is 10 days, and they have overlaid – they've overlaid amount of precipitation, temperature, and it goes out for – it's just beautiful. And I can quickly look at 10 days and get a good idea of what's going to happen. And it's just –
So instead of summarizing that down to some percentage thing, they just show you a chart of the percentage.
Sure, like it's a stacked bar chart of like how much percentage is going to – and by the way, it changes every single day. But I've been using that for like 3 years, and like we had really bad rain last year. It was spot on. I'm like, it's going to rain for the next 3 days hard. And I told that to my wife, and she's like, how do you know? Well, I'm trusting this app. So it's really good. It's really good data. It's not the most beautiful app, but for weather, if – they build trust in terms of like predicting the future for you. Well,
it's pretty much what you need.
That's what you need.
Yeah. So what do you mean it's not a solved problem?
I don't feel like we've developed the perfect weather app is the point. Like Dark Sky is good. I want a little more fidelity. Wonderground's good because the data is better. There's more fidelity, but it's kind of not that great looking. Uh-huh. So there's this combination of beauty and utility with great forecasting and data that no one solved that yet. And by the way, every time I say this, 17 people send me their weather app.
And you look at them.
Of course I look at them. And each one has one thing that's kind of cool, but there's also three things that are missing. So it's just – it's not a solved problem yet, in my opinion.
Is there a lot of money in those?
I don't think so.
Is that why it's not a solved problem?
Well, if 17 people are sending me their weather apps, it's clearly there's a data feed out there that you can part. I'm sure of it. And it's free, and you can do that. So we get down to like this visualization or this design problem, which is really, really, really hard. So, I don't think there's any money there. So, but what would I pay is now the question I'm wondering.
Yeah, we've paid for Dark Sky.
I paid for Dark Sky.
And I mean, it's always hard to figure out how you value an iPhone app, right? Especially when there's lots of weather apps out there.
Yeah.
But I'd imagine if you got one that you were like, this is perfect, you'd probably pay monthly for it at some value, right?
Why not? I would. Yeah, but I'm wondering what the incremental value is that I'd be looking for, because, like, I pay for Strava, which is this it's this online service for working out and measuring your bike rides and whatnot, monthly. I think it's monthly or quarterly. I don't know what it is, but I'm paying for it on a regular basis, and that is because I want that app to exist and that community to exist.
Oh,
so
interesting.
I wonder if there's an equivalent for a weather app where
what community aspect does the Strava app have?
It's kind of got all the social things in there. So I post a ride that I did, and I can get thumbs up from folks. And there's clubs.
And other people that run a ride around you, they can also say, I did that same ride?
You can do that. And also it'll show you like who you passed when you're doing that.
Oh,
also,
that's cool.
There's a Slack. You can do a group, like all of everyone who's biking at Slack is in this group. Everyone who's in my leadership Slack who's in there, they've got a group as well. So it's this really kind of lightweight sort of community piece. And I'm paying for that to exist.
Because you want that to exist.
I need that to exist.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know what the equivalent is for a weather app, though.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm just curious. When you see a problem like that, you know the weather app's not a solved problem. You know that the productivity app's not a solved problem. You've also probably seen really great brains go down that rabbit hole for long periods of time.
A lot of smart people.
Yeah. Omni Group, for example, spends a lot of time on OmniFocus, and it's an awesome app.
Yep. Absolutely.
And it's an unsolved problem still.
It is still an unsolved problem, but an admirable space to go work in.
You don't want to right now because you recognize that problem. Go, I'm going to go do that. Or is there too many of those in your life?
It's a really good question. I think we might have talked about this last time. I'm the guy that takes it from 100 to a 2,000. So that's my shtick. So someone else is going to go and build the great weather app company, and they're going to find that thing that we don't know what it is. That's a recurring revenue stream, and there's lots of money there. And they're going to hire 40 engineers, and they're going to all, well, people are hard, and there's all these engineers, and they're getting mad.
And that's when you come in.
who do we need? Yeah. Maybe LOP's available. Probably not, because I'll be at Slack for a good long time. But that's kind of my shtick.
Okay.
And 2% of me is a little bit sad about that. But I've come to terms with it, because this is the third time in a row that I've done that. And I just love the problem set.
Do you think that if you found your weather app solution, you'd change your tone? Or do you like the idea of supporting someone else that's done that? I mean, where does that boundary exist for you?
This is sort of a lesson I have to teach a lot of new engineering managers. And it's what I truly believe is your job is the health and the growth of the team. That's what I do. That's the product that I build.
That is your product.
That
yeah.
is my product. So whether we're building a beautiful catalog of ideas at Pinterest or this amazing way of reimagining how people work at Slack, I deeply care about the product. But the product does not exist unless those teams of builders are like cranking and getting things done. So that's the thing I'm working on, and I'm always trying new things and innovating there. If the perfect amazing idea showed up, like the one I've been talking about for a couple of years, is I would love a service that did really good sourcing on information. So if you tell me that, by the way, in 2017, Arkansas was the number one exporter of tobacco, you could somehow magically source that to the actual data that provides. Because in this day and age, people are not really caring about facts a lot.
Yeah.
I just think there's something really interesting there from a sourcing perspective. But what is that product and how would you do that?
That's what you want, really.
That's right. but you know, it could be something that could show up. But I like that building the builders thing that I do.
That is your killer app,
that's,
right?
That's my job.
Why is Bear important? Bear is an app you use on your phone, but also on your desktop.
What is this magical thing? Are you a Dropbox person?
I am.
Yeah, so you have your set of folders when you probably got presentations and whatever is going on.
And a journal, which is like where you know I do my journaling.
Yeah, so I'm super loved. I've written many love notes about Dropbox, and I've been using it for years, and I still use it. My usage of Dropbox has gone down about 70% because of Bear. So Bear is it's a text editor. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous design. Wonderful typography. It's what I wanted out of an editor for a good long time. There's not a lot of bells and whistles, because if there's bells and whistles, I will ring the bells and blow the whistles and annoy everybody. It's just, I need simple, because I'm getting in, I'm writing. So very simple markdowns in there. And it's this thing that they tried to do with, remember when they, for iWork, they got rid of the save menu?
Yeah.
And because they're like, you don't need to save.
It'll auto save.
And everyone's like mad because they wanted that sense of like, I need to hit save because otherwise something
bad
is
exactly
ding. And they put it back in there, by the way, because everyone was freaking out about it, even though it really does save really well for you. There is, I don't think there's a save in Bear. It's really doing it. And more importantly, or I don't know if it's important, it's in the iCloud storage, mm-hmm. which I didn't even know, right, that it was there until I fired up Bear up on my phone and everything that was on my desktop was there. And I was like, this is magical.
Right.
And there is no save. It's the first app. And again, Apple was prescient. They tried to
They've
do this a while.
They've been preaching for a long time, yeah.
Don't worry about save. We'll guide it for you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This is all, it just completely works.
I've heard really bad things about iCloud syncing stuff.
I've heard that as well. I have had zero problems with it. And by the way, I don't even care because it's just magically working for me.
Right.
And they have a beautiful, it's a recurring revenue. I'm paying for it. I think it's a monthly fee mm-hmm. of like a couple of bucks. Which everyone's like, that's great. I'm fine with that because they're adding new features and it's gorgeous. They have this beautiful like programmer themes that are very, very like appealing to me, like yeah. dark and beautiful highlights and whatnot. But
it's not a code editor, right? It's a writer.
It's a writer. They've started going to code editor, I see from recent notes, but I'm using it all for writing.
Yeah. I do a lot more code writing, of course. And so even when I'm doing my journaling, I use the same environment because, of course, you get used to it.
Yep.
But I can see why, as a writer, as a primarily a writer of English, having a nice app is nice. I'm curious, though. First off, I totally agree with the idea that pay recurring because you want the app to keep getting better. And
yeah.
if they have a one-time fee, then yeah. the app's going to be stale.
Yeah.
If it has a recurring revenue, they can keep investing.
Yes.
So look for apps that have recurring revenue,
yes.
really.
Exactly.
But why is it better than the 700 other editors out there? Because I'm assuming you've tried some.
I've tried, I think, 714.
Okay. See, I didn't know there was 714. I thought it was only 700.
Things that matter to me, and these are not prioritized, the typography has to speak to me, and they use this beautiful Avenir Next typeface that I think is gorgeous. You know good design when you sit down and use it. They've just taken away all of the noise, including the save menu, from the process. Really clever tagging. So I'm doing the current book in it, all in a set of tags. I can go and easily look at the chapters and the sections of the books.
You're doing your current book in Markdown?
Yeah, I am.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did you have the books in Markdown?
No, they were all in like text edit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just put in whatever the publisher needed
the
me
publisher,
to do.
Okay, yeah. Last step kind of thing.
But it's all organized, so I can easily search it and do all the things in there. But it just comes down to the beauty. Sorry, if I had to pick one thing. It's a beautiful. I mean, it just works, right?
Yeah.
It's just working for me. So,
why do you like Markdown?
It's a nice set of small conventions to like, I don't need fancy. I need headlines. I need bold. I need italics.
Describe Markdown because some people aren't going to be familiar with it.
Yeah. It's just Markdown is a text-based conventions to do formatting. For example, a blog post for me, I start with a hashtag, which is a heading, which is a big, huge, it's usually formatted in a big, huge typeface.
The main heading of the page.
The main heading of the page. Bold is two asterisks around each thing. Italics is underlines around it.
And the benefit when you have an editor that actually does this for you automatically, you're writing. Do you write it and it's being transformed into bold as you've bit of space after?
No, it actually shows me. It'll do it bold. It shows it bold. It'll show me bold with the formatting around it, so I can see that it's bold, which is nice, as opposed to other things where it's just asterisks. Which is nice. So it does a little bit of that formatting, but
Got
it still leaves that there.
So if you do a hashtag, it's still there, but it still gets bold.
Yeah.
It still gets big.
Well, it gets big, and in that case, actually, the hashtag goes away, and it puts a little note next to it that it's an H1, which is
okay.
that type of heading.
Comparable.
So
yeah.
I can paste that straight into WordPress, and everything is just formatted, which is lovely.
And do you do that when you're posting your blog?
I'm writing it all in Markdown, which is just – it takes care of all that formatting piece.
Yeah.
And then once it lands there – whatever formatting things I do on a website over the next 10 years, they will just magically transform. And I say, hey, I'm totally into sans serifs or serifs or whatever
right.
the hell I do. You know?
Yeah, the portability of Markdown is one of the benefits. Everyone knows that if they've
yeah.
worked on a document in college, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Serious problem. Okay. So there's some of your – so that's why you want to use Bear. That's cool. I'm glad to know that.
You should check it out. It's pretty cool.
I think I might. And at the same time, because it's not a code editor – challenging because, of course, I'm always looking at a code editor. I've never found a good one.
Yeah.
And now that I'm working.
What do you use, Sublime? What do you use?
I use Sublime a lot. And it's
Sublime's
kind of still my
really,
go-to.
Yeah.
I've went over to Microsoft Code, MS Code,
right.
Mostly because of the plugin infrastructure is pretty nice. And we're
yeah.
some of the gulp features and such are really nice. But of course, I'm lots of the time in Xcode because I'm an iOS developer and I'm doing – that's what you do.
Yep.
And that editor does drive you a little crazy.
Yeah.
But when you toggle between editors, of course, you never get good at any of them. So it's one of those things of deciding if I want to jump into it full stream. We also use IntelliJ here because we have large Java infrastructure in the back end. So I'm on like four different editors all the time.
Wow. That sounds like a drag.
And of course, VI whenever you do git commits. Yeah.
Dang.
That's annoying, isn't it? I should solve that problem for myself. That sounds like, just describing it sounds bad.
No, it's stressing me out just to hearing that. Like that context switching would drive me nuts.
Yeah. Do you do email through that for Bear? Oh, that's right. You don't do email.
What's email?
So last time
you were here. Tell me about this.
You just slid past this idea. We talked briefly about it. So since chatting with you around the office, at Netflix, we use Slack.
Good.
We use email, Gmail. We use Google Documents, lots of them, right?
Yep.
And so after chatting with you, I'm chatting around the office and at the lunch and talking with a bunch of people. I'm like, yeah, Slack, everyone in Slack, they don't use email, of course. And people are like, yeah, that makes sense. I'm like, yeah, but they're functional. So what are they doing? And so then like, well, how do they do that? And so people ask questions of, how do you not have email? Here's a few examples because now I'm paying attention to it.
Right.
Somebody says, we're working on a project. This is a global email to this mailing list, basically, that says,
right.
This mailing list is like, every time we're about to launch something, we send a note to this so everybody knows that's happening.
Yep.
Where do you do that? Where do you do those in? A room called announcements?
That's correct. Or general, which is the default channel that everyone is part of when they get there. But announcements.
Okay.
You cannot stump me on this. I have thought through.
I know. I'm not planning on stumping you.
I'm learning. Everything has been mapped. All of those things have been mapped into Slack, and it's a joy. It's a delight.
One of the things you recommended is that your one-on-ones, you just start up a one-on-one with anybody you do normal one-on-ones with. You start up a room, and you call it one-on-one, and you put out topics.
Yeah.
The number two people, very effective.
Yeah.
Because even when we've forgotten stuff, it's still there in history.
Yeah.
Right? We can roll back to it. So that's a nice little feature. I used to do it by spinning up a doc with that person and share the doc with them, which is fine in some sense, but then you're always kind of looking for that doc and such.
Well, so my staff meeting, we have a doc, which is the agenda, because we want to have that running log.
You want to edit it.
We want to edit it, and we put it up, and someone's taking notes when the meeting's going on so we can go back and see what was talked about, or someone who wasn't there and be like, you talked about space. What happened there?
Mm-hmm.
That doc is just pinned to a channel, and it's everyone knows that the running agenda – doc, excuse me, is just pinned to the channel. So artifacts hanging off the channel is another thing.
That's useful.
That's in posts, Google Docs, whatever you're using. That's such a good way to kind of hang artifacts that have the context of the channel.
Yeah. Okay. So I won't go into a lot of that because I feel like it, as you're using Slack, you get the idea of it. But one of the things you need to do is start using that tool well, because it's part of your workflow. You know, getting good at it.
Yep.
So one of the things we're going to trade a couple tricks. I'm going to do one, then you're going to do one.
Great.
I don't know what yours are. First one mine is Command-K, and it might be also Command-T, which basically just gives you a text field. And as you start typing it, all the people that you Slack with directly are there, and all the channels that you're subscribed to are there.
Called a quick switcher.
Quick switcher.
Yes.
And then once you find the one you want, you hit enter. So now instead of using the mouse and looking around, I'm always using that feature to jump around between rooms.
I think we can agree that if that was one tip that I wanted everyone to know, it's that. Because that gives you instant access to everything.
Yes.
Channels, people. And also we do this thing in there. We sort it by frequency, which is –
Frequency.
Nice. So frequency and recenceness. So if you're DMing me a lot, I'm Michael or I'm Lop, you're going to see me at the top of the list. And your channels that you regularly use is going to be up there as well.
So if I just do Command-K, even if I don't know what room I was last in, it's going to be right there.
If you've done it a lot recently or you've done it frequently.
Okay.
So some magical combination of those two things.
A little bit of algo there.
A little algo.
Yeah. And if, of course, I could start typing Michael or I could start typing Lop in either one, you're going to start filtering down to that.
Yeah, that's the power user feature, especially when you're getting up to a lot of people there. And a lot of channels, and they don't all fit in your sidebar.
So Command-K and Command-T, are they equivalent? I can't remember.
Is Command-T the same?
Someone just told me today, it's Command-T. I was like, no, it's Command-K. So
it might
maybe
be
it's
the
different.
Same thing. I use Command-K.
Yeah,
so,
I do too.
Yeah.
Apple.
Apple.
Okay. Give me another one.
Command-Shift-K. I always get that look when someone's out there like that. Command-Shift-K brings you to this thing where you can construct a multi-party DM, MPDM. So it's not just you and I chatting. It's all four of us. It's actually not the reveal yet. Below that is a list of all your recent DMs and multi-party DMs that you've done. So if you're creating a lot of
private... auto-filters you into the DM space.
Yes, it goes in that, and it gives you recent ones, a long list of them. So if you're like me where I'm only in Slack, I can go look at that and see who... I just DM'd Shelley, and then I created this multi-party one with Cal and Shelley and this sort of thing. So it's a great sort of way to kind of go back and find those recent conversations.
So if you or I are in multiple DM spaces, and I know you and I were chatting and we're in a DM about something,
yeah.
I start typing Command-Shift-K, start typing LOP, then yeah. It says like four of them recent. Oh, there's the one with Kelly in it. That's what I want.
That's exactly
okay,
right.
I got it.
Yeah.
The multi-DM thing has been a little confusing to me in the sense that right. I can never remember which ones I've been in and who's in what.
Yeah.
You can also add people to them, yep. which requires you to kind of approve that because you're about to show all old history
yeah.
context.
Same with private channels. Yeah. If you're inviting someone into a private channel, we want to make sure that do you understand that everything that you're about to see is – everything that's been said prior to this person being there is not visible – is going to be visible to this person.
It is the fix to the reply all accidentally.
Yes, absolutely.
Which people do all the time.
They do, I don't miss reply all at all.
I bet you don't. Not the podcast. The podcast is great. The email feature that mistakenly makes you share secret information
but
incorrectly.
The thing is, we replaced it with this really delightful emoji reaction thing. So like you were talking about announcements. I get a lot of very non-scientific sentiment analysis when we post something to our worldwide announcement channel.
We just add this great new feature, Command-K. Well,
Yeah. And then what happens is there's this huge like parade of emoji reactions, which is mostly fun, but it's also interesting. I know the difference between a message that was well received and one that was kind of landed with a thud, or people have questions because you just look at the emoji. It's like, oh, it's all happy dancing penguins and party parrots and whatnot, yeah. as opposed to, oh, they're curious about this one. There's the brain and there's the question mark emoji and this sort of thing. And it's like, how would you do that sort of analysis of your team?
Especially so quickly.
So quickly, yeah. right? You'd like, oh, I got to run a culture amp survey and we'll know how they react to that message like 3 months later. So there's this real-time aspect. This is our secret weapon.
Yeah. I had one more that I wanted to talk about, and that is hiding channels.
Mm-hmm.
So as you start using Slack more and more, you start getting more and more channels and it starts getting noisy. Your sidebar starts getting noisy.
Yep.
And someone around the office recently was like, oh, no, just go and change it to only show you ones that have threads in them, that things that's content currently.
No, spread. Unreads or new content.
New yeah. content or hide not
yep.
active, whatever. I turned that on the desktop. I didn't turn that on the phone.
Yeah.
And I like the duality of that.
Yeah.
I feel like my desktop space is much – it's cleaner to get it to a zero inbox
yeah,
place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
Slack
the phone
zero.
Was Slack zero. Yeah, of course, sorry. You knew what that meant. And on the phone, I still keep it around because it still feels like also I want that recency. It'd be
yeah.
nice. But now that I know Command-K actually has a frequent recency, what do you call it?
Frequency.
I'll start using that more to get that context. Okay. So Slack has this great quality of being an easy space to communicate in
yeah.
and such. I've used it for pretty personal spaces. I use it for mm-hmm. my podcast. I use it for other places. I've subscribed to other people's wonderful Slack channels like your one about Rand's on – what is it called?
Rand's Leadership Slack.
Leadership Slack, which if you're interested in, go to your site and you'll read about it.
Yep.
And recently someone was saying – there's been a lot of discussion about dropping Facebook and deleting Facebook. And,
mm-hmm.
and Elon Musk even like pulled the sites of his companies
right,
down
right.
kind of cleverly of himself. He's
yeah.
very good at that kind of thing. But there's been a few threads of like, well, what do you replace XYZ with? Well, how do you get off of that and still have this wonderful feature of everyone having an account?
Right.
And one of the suggestions people made was, I'll just spin up a Slack channel and invite people,
mm-hmm.
invite your neighbors and create a channel for that. Do you think that's a viable solution, a use for your service?
I do. I mean, I'm biased because I work there, but let's try to be unbiased for a second and just say that, let me step back. I have this piece I'm writing right now. It's called Welcome Back to the Village. And there was, remember pre-Facebook and Google, there was like tribe.net and there were these other kind of small precursors to social networks. They were more intimate, I guess. I don't know, but they didn't succeed. And then all these other things showed up and turned into these large behemoths. I think I'm biased, but I think there is a return to less toxic, anonymous kind of nightmare social networks.
And more focused.
More focused. And I call them villages in my head just because in a village, we kind of know each other. Even though we're not friends, we're like here for a reason because it's our home, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that Strava is, this is a line from the piece, is a
this
village.
This is the biking one.
This is the biking one. It's a village. It's like, it's not a, like a tight-knit village, but we are there because we have a shared purpose of we are biking together or running or whatever the sport is. And that's that brings us together. One of my favorite things about biking is when I stop on the side of the road to like eat my, you know, Kind bar and drink my water, like a biker goes by 8 times out of 10 and I'm not in distress. I'm just sitting there having my Kind bar. They're like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm okay. That's great. I mean, like, imagine that on the planet Earth, like with people just kind of like, you okay?
We'd be so much happier.
We'd be so much happier. And that's because we both identify as bikers, right? It's really simple. And that's a village of bikers. And I think these are much healthier groups of humans. And I think there's folks that obviously are going to want to like find that sort of thing. And I think you could do that inside of Slack, but you could do that a lot of places. You can do that inside of Strava. You could do that. I'm sure there's other places
In
Reddit and this sort of thing. And that's, I think that's really, there's a, I was talking to a VC about, I think there's a really huge opportunity there for small, not exclusive, because that turns into a whole other thing, but a smaller, more intimate, more purpose-based sort of communities where people have to kind of put a little bit of themselves into it and their names on the words, mm-hmm. because a lot of the toxicity out there is just people have no commitment to being a part of this group. They're just there to kind of troll and kind of just push the button because they're mad about the thing, which could be very valid. But what you find when it's a village, when you find that someone's putting their name on their or picture on their words, there's a higher bar that they have to hold themselves to, mm-hmm. I think. So I'd like to think that that's – I think Slack could do that, but I just think that people need those sorts of groups. Yeah, and more kind groups too, I think.
Are you – I mean, I'm sure right now your main focus for the company of Slack – I mean, not just you, I mean, the company itself is to, you know, find the places where you're really effective in a business space because they're going to do big purchases and that's your main model.
Yep.
And then you have this other service of letting people in and free versions and things.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself, the company going, you know what, we really could also create that kind of interface focused around, you know, maybe geographic Slack channels, things of that nature?
That's nothing. In the short-term plans there, because we're really just making the first version, the Slack we have here ready, as you said, really like a viable business.
Yeah. And you want to stay focused on that.
I want to stay focused on that thing. I learned that at Apple. You know, like, do one thing well, like, and do it really well. That creates opportunities to do things in the future. But right now it's that do that one thing well.
We have a mantra here at Netflix the same way, right? Like, do it. Do that streaming video thing really well.
Really, really well. Yeah.
There's lots of things you could derail yourself on really as a company.
Mm-hmm. And the Slack concept, we've just talked about some of the things there is so – it's. I mean, you're used to it. You use it here at Netflix. I obviously use it a lot. But majority of the people on the planet Earth that could really benefit from sort of a reimagining of their communication hub around Slack, that's all future. That's all future business for us. And it's not an easy concept. Most people start and think it's messaging. I'm like, yeah, no, it's everyone there real-time responding 25 times faster than email. And then it's the integrations, and then it's the ability to search, and it's knowledge management, all these other things. Yeah. And when people get that, they're like, what? But we got to start with like, hey, by the way, it's real time and everyone's there. And that's going to be so much more healthier just from your sanity perspective.
Was there any of the Slack tricks that you had? Or
I am big on this thing. This is my personal opinion right now of Slack being this knowledge management tool and getting people in that mindset of like everything is there and useful. And it's my advice.
It's not just pinning. It's anything you put in. Yeah.
Anything in there. We have this debate and we come to an accord, right? And that decision is like captured in this channel that we have, which is why I always advise people to default to public channels. I think there's a lot of people that are, and this is a cultural thing, and Slack is different than IBM, which is different than Netflix. But just imagine this world of where you can like for things that aren't, you know, like private or like personal information, right? Where everything's kind of shared in that way. And that's default public channels, I think, is something which can be magical if people kind of get their mind around it. So
we do that with Google Docs mostly. Like most of the documents we kind of share with everybody because who knows who needs the context. It's always useful to have availability.
Yeah, who knows? And if they do good search there, give folks the ability to find that stuff. It's the content that keeps on giving, right?
I'm assuming that's a space that you're investing a lot of time and energy into because it's very hard to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, the team's called SLI, Search Learning Intelligence. It's based in New York, and that's their job is when you search for a thing that you see your answer to your thing in the top three results, right? Yep. Quickly, right? Like, I'm looking for that doc that Lyle and I talked about or whatever that, you know.
Yeah.
And it's obviously, search is hard.
Search is, really, yeah. First off, this is spoiler alert. We're going to talk about this movie.
Yes.
And the movie's The Last Jedi. What's wrong with The Last Jedi?
Did you read the article?
I did. Okay. I read it. We're going to talk about that. So you basically, instead of writing like your opinion of it, you wrote this wonderful narrative like they had a pitch meeting
right.
about how they could make it better.
Right.
Which they didn't actually do.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they did. Maybe they will.
No one ever figured this out, so I'm going to say it here to the people who are listening to this. Go read the article because there's this table in the – it's not a lot of like description, but the table is the Death Star. And no one ever picked up on it.
Yeah, sure. It felt very Star. You described it as gray and a black molecule.
But no one ever said, "Oh, it's the Death Star." Maybe it was too obvious. But no one ever said, "Oh, are they sitting at the Death Star?" Anyway, what's wrong with The Last Jedi? So first off, why do I know this? Because every time that I go see a movie with my family, the best part of the movie is the 20-minute drive home where the kids and the wife and I all debate the movie.
Yes.
Because we're all like, we love movies.
Yes.
And so it's so much fun.
The family debate's the best. I love it. I love it. It's one of those things that's so hard when you're in a group of people and you want to talk about it and you ask around, who's not seen this? And someone raises their hand, you're like, I really want to talk about this.
I was late on Blade Runner and like my family was...
The new one.
The new one. It was, my family was very angry with me. By the way, phenomenal movie.
Yeah. Okay, wait a second. Jedi. I mean, I'm sorry.
Blade Runner.
First off, this is spoiler alert. We're going to talk about this movie. Blade Runner. I feel the lead was not emotional enough, not human enough. I know that, of course, is silly because he's not.
Right.
But
spoiler alert. I guess, no, that's not a spoiler. Yeah.
Well, it might be a spoiler alert. I mean, debate of always, of course.
I thought he was majestic.
You liked him.
I loved his torture. He was tortured, right? He was emotionally tortured. There's a scene where he learns, he's talking to the daughter of Deckard. We don't know this at that point, and realizes that little piece of wood that he has, that memory is
somebody else's,
mm-hmm. and the freak out he has, I thought was just master.
That fit.
I was moved. So I think the length is.
You're right. The loss there was really palpable. The idea of losing a memory, really horrifying.
Yeah, he's like, I'm the chosen one. It's like every story ever, right? And no, you're not. You're really just like this manufactured thing. And like, wow. And so I thought he was amazing.
Right.
I thought Harrison was, he was fine.
He was fine.
He was fine. But it was,
I wasn't disappointed by him.
I wasn't disappointed, but it wasn't like, I was like, oh my gosh. So, but I did a visual feast and just in world building. I thought it was a beautiful,
movie. And that's some of the things they do of Decker kind of living in this no man's land.
Yeah.
And everybody was kind of afraid of it. It kind of made sense. It fit, you know.
It was an homage to Vegas and all of that as well.
It was really nice.
And where it was Vegas, I don't know.
The other thing that was interesting, of course, of seeing him redo a character that I love, you know, and be him again, like with Han. Of course, seeing him as Han, I just loved every single second of it. Just I felt it and loved it.
Yeah.
With Blade Runner, I was like, oh, cool. They have, you know, I knew he was in it and everything.
Yeah.
I was like, let's see how this works. And it worked for me. It was okay.
Right.
But it wasn't the kind of emotional impact that Star Wars does for me.
Yeah. And I've rewatched the first Blade Runner. He was icy cold and hard in that movie.
He was mean. Yeah.
And I thought it was great.
Yeah. He's a killer. I mean, he's supposed to be, right?
He was that. And there was something that wasn't that, and maybe that was just sort of matured with age or something, but mm-hmm. it didn't have that sort of impact on me.
Okay, The Last Jedi.
Yeah, so there's a problem in the second act. Rey should have turned.
Why?
Because...
And you're talking about Rey should have turned when they're facing...
When they're facing Snoke, she should have, like, gone for it. And
I got to say, when I read this today,
right.
I was like, oh my God, that would have been so beautiful. It would have been so hard to watch, you know?
Right.
It would have been, it's great because, you know, when Anakin turns evil, you're like, yeah, of course he does.
Yeah,
like,
well, we knew it's going to happen, right?
But for her to do it would have been a beautiful time, you know?
But she's not really turned. And we don't know that in this movie because you got to just believe that she turned because we're doing things differently here, right? Thanks, Rian Johnson. Ryan? I don't know how to say his name. But that would have been – there was no tension. There's no – we leave the end of this movie. There is no villain.
Yeah.
Because Kylo, is...
Well, Kylo's a villain. I mean, he's going to try to kill...
Everybody loves... I know he's bad and he's angsty and all that sort of thing, but it's his redemption. Hopefully it's going to happen, but I think it is his redemption. Like, we're all rooting for him. He's the best character in the movie, right?
Why do we love him so much? I mean, he kills Han. How can we love him? I mean, I honestly do. I think he's wonderful.
Right. Well, first of all, the actor is amazing. Adam Driver is just, like, he's just the seething that he's doing.
He could do anything, and I'd love it.
No, I agree with that. I don't know. I don't have a good answer to your question. But he's not the villain.
No, he's not the villain.
The villain got killed.
I agree with you in that aspect. He killed the villain.
Yeah.
And I'm a little disappointed with the death of the villain, honestly.
I kind of
like the surprise of it aspect of it.
Yep.
But I'm also kind of like, wow, you really are good at manipulating.
Yeah.
And yet... You haven't shown much of that. I didn't see much manipulation. I mean, I feel like Han knew he was going to be killed. Like, I don't feel there was any time where we've been like, wow, he's really devious.
Yeah.
And then he's extremely devious enough to, you know, totally surprise this arch nemesis mind control man.
Yeah. So what's the tension going into the next movie? Okay.
It's like you could end the series.
Yeah,
you really
could have been the end.
You need another film.
Yeah. So he come – anyway, so that's the problem.
So that's the problem with it.
That tension is – attention is gone.
I like the Raiders of the Lost Ark chasing to thing you described too. That there is that when I left the big family group that was talking about this, was like, what did they do? They didn't do anything. They go off to this planet. You
useless.
See pretty things.
Yeah.
Completely like fun chasing whatever.
Completely
useless.
Yeah.
And then it comes back. It's not even useful. Like that's not even useful. And also the whole idea of escaping but able to escape and come back while you're escaping seems a little ridiculous as well.
Yeah.
There's some problems with the film.
Yeah, there was some – it was not my favorite one. It wasn't the worst. It was still ahead above, I thought, the first three or one, two, and three. And I don't actually have a problem with him deviating. I think the thing that he's doing is – that I think is really clever is he's making the Force not about the Skywalkers. And he's making it more – it's about everybody, and anyone can do it. And I thought that was that thing at the end of the last scene that
the mob,
It was just like I thought it was just brilliant, and it moved me. But it's still, I don't know what our tension is, right? And we have the whole now. I'm sure that Leia had a major role in the third original next movie, and I don't know what they're going to do about that. Like, because I felt like her job was to redeem him because he didn't shoot when he could have shot, right? So I think they have this sort of – and I have high faith in J.J. Abrams to create a great popcorn movie, by the way.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
He'll be fine. But I still like who's the villain?
Yeah. Were you surprised or upset by Leia surviving the explosion?
The Force power thing, the Mary Poppins move?
Yeah. Mary Poppins move, nice.
No, we know she has it. It seemed strange to me, but I had the same problem with Guardians of the Galaxy when people that are like out in space and surviving.
Survive it,
You know, I'm like, I don't think that happens. I guess we get it now that Peter Quill was like half God and Gamora is like half machine or something like that. But you die. So,
it's interesting because when she died in that way, I thought that, well, there you go. That's how Leia goes.
Yeah.
That was surprising to me because, of course, I'm expecting her not to be available because she's passed away.
I wasn't prepared for her to die at that point. So I was expecting her to come back.
I loved her in a closing scene with Luke. That whole aspect I thought was wonderful.
Yeah.
The passing of what we think is a real object.
Yep.
That whole thing was nice. I'm glad she was there for that scene.
Yeah. The Luke twist and also sort of the middle twist of the villain getting killed, I thought were two quality moves.
The Luke twist was excellently done.
Yeah.
I love the aspect in seeing it the second time of him going, I'm never going to leave here.
Right.
And then you're like, all right, he said that. And he didn't. I love that.
Yeah.
It's so funny because I really did not get what he was doing when he's being bombarded by those things. I knew he was going to live. I didn't think he was dying.
Right, right.
But I did not know what magic they were going to do for that.
Yeah.
And I didn't get that until halfway through the, you know, hand-to-hand kind of battle space. And I'm like, oh, he's not really there.
Yeah.
That was well done.
Yeah, and also that he chose the look of a younger Luke just to enrage Kylo, which I didn't get until the movie was over.
No, second pass, I'm like, oh, right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not him. He's actually got a larger beard and all those things.
Yeah.
So there was some elegance to it. Also, I love the – I don't know who came up with the red underneath the white salt thing.
Beautiful.
It was really gorgeous.
Yeah. There's a lot of pretty in that film.
There's a lot of pretty.
What do you think about the ramming of – why don't they do that more often?
You mean just shoot the ship through?
Shoot the ship through a whole bunch of a fleet.
I mean, first off,
shoot the ship through a Death Star.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
That was my favorite part. It was just beautiful. The sound effects around it. It was quiet. It was just, I thought it was
unusual. It was unusual for Star Wars to be quiet like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why. Like, you do that every time. Just YOLO, like, point the ship out there. That seems like a power move.
Break into a Death Star and drive it through the...
One person and you take out the command ship, right? Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't actually thought of that.
Yeah. So that was a little disconcerting. There's a few of those in the film.
Yeah, but they'll go for pretty before, like, utility.
And, you know, like, in the first of the new series, the... having the planet killer thing shooting the beam, and you see the ships, you know, the whole shrinking of the galaxy to show that scene.
Right.
I forgive it because it was pretty, and it's really hard to explain that kind of concept without visualizing it. So, what's your favorite of the films?
Of all of them?
Yeah. And you can only pick one.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Oof.
It used to not be hard, but it's gotten harder.
Yeah. It was always Empire. The Force Awakens was really good.
It was.
It was really, it hit all the points. But I still am a Empire guy just because source material.
Yep.
JJ did Star Trek and Star Wars. He's so good at that. Like, well, what's important to the audience? What did they care about? And I'm going to hit all of those points. And I think that drives him crazy, by the way, because he wants to be like the original guy. He's great at that, right? So, but it's still Empire just because... That was when everything was clicking, and it set the tone for like what a good one is.
Right. All the other films don't. Yep. I mean, they're there because of Empire. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. I'd love to know if it ever changes. It hasn't changed for me, but I definitely am in that space.
Did have that debate again after the last Force Awakens.
Awakens.
Oh, wow. This
is the one I've gone. No, you have to see this film. Like it's a good one.
Agreed. Agreed.
Well, thank you so much. I want to make sure that everybody knows that they can follow you at Rans on Twitter. And, of course, they can read all your writings and access to your books at ransinrepose.com. And I highly recommend it. Michael, thanks so much for joining me today.
Great to be here. Love coming back.
All right. Good. I hope to do it again.
Yep.